So, firstly, let's start at the beginning. So, how did you come to be part of the peace movement in general?
I wasn't really. I just went to Greenham with some friends.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, I can't remember precisely. I mean, we must have talked about it before I went, but I was never in CND or anything like that. That didn't happen.
Okay, so Greenham was your first experience of that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, when did you first come to Greenham?
December the 12th, 1983.
Cool. And that was Embrace the Base?
Embrace the Base, yes.
Bav. How did you find out about that?
Through friends. I mean, you know, there was a network, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody spoke to each other about things. Just my mates told me.
Do you remember? So you went there with friends originally.
Yeah.
How many of you were there?
There was a, well, we were all in, we were in a car and it was packed, so there must have been five of us.
Yeah. Do you, were you aware of other people going as well that you knew?
Just
you?
Just us lot.
Cool. How old were you when you first?
25.
Cool.
In fact, no, I was 24 then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, did you have any expectations of what Greenham?
I had no idea what I was letting myself in for. I just thought it sounded like fun. It sounded like a good thing to do. Yeah, I was going with my mates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you arrived, what was your first kind of memories of?
It was total organised chaos. I mean, seriously, there was just coaches and cars and banners and whistles and mud and women and dogs and children and women, and it was just amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And the base, of course, right there in the middle of it, the base. I didn't even know what the base was going to look like. I had no expectations.
What did it look like?
Just a big green fence. Well, it was big gates because we went to the yellow gate, main gate, because we didn't know anywhere. I didn't even know there were other gates. You know, we rocked up there because that's what the map said, I suppose, or we just followed people. I wasn't driving, so I couldn't tell you, but I could ask the person who was. But, yeah, I just remember seeing the big main gates locked shut and then just the green chain link fence.
Yeah. So when you got there, was there someone telling you
where
to go?
There must have been, but I don't remember that. There must have been.
Yeah. And so then with Embrace the Base, I know that, you know, you were holding hands around the base. Did you know, I'm just really curious, did you know that that's what you were there to do?
Yes. We were there to embrace the base. That was the call out. That's why we had to go, because it was a 9-mile perimeter fence, so they needed everybody. So yeah, that was a really good incentive, actually. It was a very, very clever action.
And it worked.
And it worked! I know! We did it! Yay! 9 miles of women. It's phenomenal. 30,000 women. You think about that now. God, I wish we'd do that now.
It really is amazing to me that I've said it before, but it's that thing of, you know, not having the internet, not having mobile phones, you know, just that organisation being done
over landline.
Over landline and, you know, posters and things. Like, it's really phenomenal.
Yeah, there must have been posters. Something must have alerted us to it. Maybe in the 121 bookshop, you know, because we were part of that Rebel Dyke movement. You know, without even knowing that's what we were doing, we were already the anarchists, you know, the left wing, the squatters. So that probably it was there, actually. Because I've got copies of Crowbar from back then, so obviously we were quite involved in the squatting
movement.
Sorry,
what's Crowbar?
Oh, God, you wouldn't get it now. It was a magazine, a photocopied magazine about squatting.
Oh, right, okay.
What to do. Yeah.
Makes sense. Good name.
Crowbar.
Okay, cool. So, do you remember who you were holding hands with?
Must have been my mates, one on each side. With my girlfriend at the time. And we were all lesbians.
Yeah. Well, did you find that, I know we're moving forward a bit at your time at Greenham, but did you find that, you know, being a lesbian was a big part of your experience at Greenham there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd been very, very isolated up until then. You know, we barely knew any other lesbians. I mean, for real. You know, life was very, very different then. You know, there was constant harassment, you could lose your job, you'd get your kids taken away. You know, it wasn't a walk in the park being gay then. It was very, very difficult. And so we were very isolated. You know, the five of us had all slept together because we didn't know any other lesbians. That was it, really. So just to go there and realise that I wasn't the only one, but me and these four women were the there were more out there. It was it was phenomenal. It was just such a revelation.
Yeah,
it was brilliant.
It's amazing to me actually now to hear that it was so, that you felt isolated.
Completely. I think, you can't imagine.
No, I can't actually. No,
and that's great. And you know what? I'm really bloody pleased that you don't have to.
Yeah.
Really. It's wonderful.
Yeah. It's just amazing. Really. Mm. So you decided to stay.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I'm not leaving this. Yeah. Great.
What was so great about that action that you decided that?
It wasn't just the action. It was, like I say, where I was in my life at the time. I was very unwell. I had a lot of. I had mental health problems. You know, I was addicted to class A drugs. I was shooting up. I was very, very, very unhappy, and I just didn't see the point of coming home. I just thought I could just stay there. And I met, you know, you're no longer isolated. You've got like a community that you're now part of. And I'd never had that. You know, I'd left home in very acrimonious circumstances on my 16th birthday. So I'd never really felt I belonged. And at Greenham, I belonged. And I was important. And I was valid. And I'd never had that experience. So of course I was going to stay.
Yeah. And did your friends
decide to stay? No, they all came home. Had proper jobs and, you know, things to do, but I didn't have a job. I just lived there. Right. It was great.
So it seems like it kind of came about at this perfect time almost for you.
I mean, a year earlier would have been good. Probably not quite so destructive. But it was what it was, you know. Yeah. I mean, I'm very, very grateful. I honestly believe it saved my life. I really, really think that. I think I would be dead without it. So that's pretty good.
Yeah. What was it about Greenham that makes you say that it saved your life? Was it the community? Was it the fact that you were just away from home? Like, what was
it
that?
It was a combination of a few factors, wasn't it? It was the community, the fact that I was away from home. Of course, I was away from the environment where I was taking drugs. I was away from the people I was taking drugs with. And I had other things to do. You know, all the time I was taking drugs, I was bored. Yeah, you know, I had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it was a lifeline.
Yeah. So being at Greenham, you say you were at Main Gate, which kind of I think later became known as Yellow Gate.
Yeah. Yeah. We never called it that.
No.
No.
Because it was the original one, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was the main gate of the base.
Right. Makes sense. Because I was wondering, I think we spoke when we were speaking on the phone about this thing of the colour system and how
when
that
it happened. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have to ask someone who was there before me.
Yeah.
Because there was always Green Gate and Blue Gate. They even when I got there, they existed. So
right,
technically, we must have always been Yellow Gate, but we never called it Yellow Gate.
No.
So.
No. Was there a certain personality?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
What was that?
Well, in my experience, the Blue Gate was the one nearest the pub. And so you can walk down into Newbury and back from there. Because it's a 9-mile perimeter fence, you know. So where we were to there was a good 4.5 miles round the fence because you couldn't go through the base, unfortunately. Mm. So the one nearest the pub, that was seemed to be the younger, more boozy crowd. And then Green Gate, that was always the hippies because they were in the middle of the forest, you know, and they didn't have access to anything. And then I think Main Gate was more the rowdy, troublemaking rebel dykes. That's how I experienced it.
Right. you've got a rebel dykes badge on
right now.
As you're saying, this is brilliant. So do you want to just talk a little bit about rebel dykes and what
rebel dykes
is? Yeah.
Rebel dykes is, it started 3 years ago by Siobhan Fahey interviewing a group of women who she realised that our stories were hadn't been written in, so they've effectively been written out. Mm. And you know, before there were riot girls, there were rebel dykes. You know, we were the troublemaking, fast riding, leather wearing, tattooed, you know, drug taking bad people of the bad women, bad girls of the 1980s and 90s And yeah, you know, because of the way that history is collated, we aren't the people that get talked about. So she realised that those stories were all going to disappear. So she started to interview us, and she's got loads and loads of footage now. It's going to be a film. It will be a film. I was the first person that she interviewed, and that was when I realised, like, oh my God, this is... That's why I kept all this stuff, because I've kept so much stuff, because I must have known at one point that that would be a useful thing to do. And so when the film wasn't getting finished, I was getting a bit, you know, frustrated with the whole thing, really. And I think she'd gone off the boil a little bit. So then I wrote a show about that 40 years of lesbian history. Sistery.
Sistery.
I know, it's that good. It's not mine, but yeah.
I love it. Oh, it's great. I have to say, when you were talking about, you know, the story's not being told and being written out of history, I think that is a lot of what has really excited me about this project itself.
Yes, I bet.
Because it's women telling their own stories. Yeah. And it's, I mean, how do you feel that, did you have any experience with them, like the press at the time?
Do you know what? It was at Greenham that I realised the press lie. That had never occurred to me. It's like, it's in the paper, it must be true. And they, we did an action, and then, you know, I was there and I saw what happened. I was part of it, for goodness sake. You know, we were blockading and, you know, singing our songs, and lorries couldn't get in and out. And then the very next day, somebody came to the base with a copy of, I don't remember which paper, for argument's sake, would say the Daily Mail, because it may well have been. And this journalist had written about the action, and they'd written all these lies, like we'd gone and we'd hit people and we'd thrown things. And I was like, but that isn't... And then it dawned on me that they don't tell the truth. It never occurred to me.
No.
So, yeah, that was a wake-up call.
It's quite something to realise something.
Yeah, it was fundamental. It was really, really fundamental. It shook my belief in the society that I was in. Because I realised that it wasn't what I thought, and that was good. And I learned that I could question authority. I never knew I could do that before. I could defy authority. It never occurred to me. So yeah, maybe who I am.
Yeah.
Birth of the Rebel Diet.
I love when you said that, you were smiling so hard about defying authority.
Yeah.
Did you have fun at Greenham?
Oh God, yes. A lot of fun. I mean, the conditions were harsh, life was very difficult, but we had a lot. We were so naughty.
Yeah.
I mean, we just drove them mental.
Do you have a particular memory of kind of being naughty or defying authority?
Oh, loads. I mean, you know, there's nothing else to do. You know, apart from the basics of getting water, getting food, digging shit pits, building benders. Once you've done all your basic survival things, you know, then, you know, and shagging around, bender hopping. And then, you know, you turn your attention to, oh, I suppose we better do an action or two. Yeah, you get your bolt cutters, you go in, you know, you cut the fence, go in the base, have a look round, you know, just, we were just so, in super glue the locks, we were just so naughty. We just made their life miserable.
Yeah.
See, and there was nothing they could do.
No.
You know, and it would, of course that would never happen now. You know, there was no CCTV, number one.
Okay.
So, you know, we were there. It was us and them, really.
Yeah.
And it was a 9-mile perimeter fence, so they couldn't possibly patrol it all.
So, just thinking about that thing of this massive long fence and the kind of constant little battles.
I mean, it was a circle.
Yeah.
So, you know, wherever you were, there's no way that they could keep an eye on all of it. They just couldn't.
Going back to what you were saying before as well about just kind of living at Greenham, I mean, what was the day-to-day running of the camp?
Okay, so, when I first got there, I slept in a tent. I don't know how I got a tent. I may have even taken it with me. I had a tent and a sleeping bag and something, you know, under me. But that was a bit basic. But I was in... So where the main gate was, there was, like, you would drive up and there were two, like, banks, one on either side. And there were lots of women living on those banks. And that was, like, the really cool bit. But when I got there, you know, I didn't know anybody. So we went on a bit round to the right of that, along the fence a little bit, called the clearing, where there was some trees had been felled. And so a few of us set up home in there, a few tents, and, you know, we hung out. But eventually, I mean, I can't remember how... So what, I went in December, it was so cold, it was really cold, I remember that. So I think by about March, April, I'd made friends with the women in the what I considered to be the cooler part. And so then I built a bender, And so once you'd built a bender, and that's involves getting some silver birch branches, you stick one end in the ground, you dig a hole, put one end in the ground, you bend it over, that's the name bender, you put the other end in the ground, and you do that in a, you do that six times, and then you put a big sheet of plastic. So people donated all the plastic, the rope, the blankets. So you put big sheet of, huge big sheet of plastic over the top, so it was waterproof, and then you'd put that rocks around the bottom to hold it down. Then on the inside you'd thread blankets through so you didn't get condensation. And then honestly they were so warm, you'd just light nightlight candles and they would warm up in a heartbeat. So once I was living there, life was a bit less a bit less difficult because I had a nice warm home. So you'd get up in the morning, you'd really need a wee, so then you'd go and have a wee, and then you'd go to the main fire pit and there'd be a kettle on, so you'd make a cup of tea, and just like, you know, normal life, but outside. Imagine camping every day for like a year and a half, and there you go, in all weathers.
Yeah.
I mean, the rain was hard. Rain was really hard. But the cold, you got used to the cold. You dressed appropriately. But people donated stuff all the time. You know, we had a standpipe for water. Sometimes they took the standpipe away, but and somebody would come with another one. Yeah, it was a funny, it was a funny way to live. But we learned really good survival skills. You know, you'd get firewood because there was wood all around, because the all around the base, it was common land, so there were trees. So we'd always have firewood. People would donate firewood. There'd always be a fire burning at the main gate, always, day and night, for warmth and for cooking food. And then if you were very lucky in your tent, you'd have a little gas burner so you could heat up a kettle before you got out, or you could heat up your baked beans or whatever you were having.
Was it very much like that, the fire, was that quite a communal...
Yeah, that was like the hub.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we'd all sit around there of an evening to keep warm and sing songs and chit-chat and...
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, the trick was not to sit in the smoke seat. Because there's always one, you know, there's wind. So yeah, that's so once you got more and more savvy, you'd be like, I see where there's a space there, I'm not going to sit there. Nudge up. No. So yeah.
Yeah. And what about the meetings? How were they for you? How were they run?
I'm not a great person for group decisions and group decision-making processes. I'm not very patient like that. So I would go to them. I don't feel that I had a lot of involvement in them, to be honest.
Because it was that collective decision-making, wasn't
there? Was very much a collective decision-making, but I just kind of went along with it. I didn't feel like I had a... I don't know, I was quite young, you know, there were lots of women there that were a lot older than me, and I just sort of let them make decisions, really. I wasn't involved in that. You know, we would do actions. The lovely thing about Greenham was that there was no leaders. That's why it was impossible to stop us, because there was no one to lead us. So you just did what you wanted, really. So there, of course, there were meetings about collective actions, you know, shall we blockade on this day, at this day, go along with that. But you know, and then if you thought by yourself, actually me and X, Y and Z are just going to go in and paint something in there, you know, nobody stopped, you know, there was no hierarchy. That was what was so powerful about it. That was its strength.
Do you think that had to do with the fact it was a woman?
Of course There was no power struggle. There was no power structure. You know, we didn't need it. We knew we didn't need it. We just got on with it.
It's so exciting whenever I think about that way of living.
Yes.
Because it's just not like anything that we're told is possible.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? That's very true. It's a very different way of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it worked, you know, and of course there were issues, of course there were problems, you know, like there would be anywhere. But never to the point where we couldn't, I didn't feel things were resolved by the end of the day, you know.
Did you, we talked a little bit about, you know, the fact that you're a lesbian and feeling maybe different about your sexuality when you were at Greenham. I mean, was there... did you recognise any changes in yourself just by the time that you lived there? I don't know if that question makes any sense, but basically, did you... Yeah, did you recognise any changes in yourself in any way?
Oh, God, yeah, of course. Yeah. I became a... I think I grew up. I, well, I stopped taking drugs, so that was great. So yeah, I became well.
Yeah.
And my mental health improved exponentially because I had people that I could talk to, people that cared about me. Yeah, I mean, I became... I can't think of the word, really. Whole, more complete, you know. Just, just a more confident.
Yeah,
happier, much, much, much happier. Yeah. Much happier, yeah.
Did you forge any strong relationships?
Oh, God, I'm still friends with them now. Yeah, good. Definitely. Yeah, of course. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I had a very, very lovely girlfriend for a long time. We're still friends. Mm. So, yeah, now I've got some... Yeah. I mean, there's still a network. I wouldn't say I'm in touch with everybody, but, you know, I know where certain people are because of Facebook.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people got back in touch with other people through that.
Mm. And that's really nice, actually, that it's kind of people that you might not have been able to connect with.
I think for everybody, Facebook has done that, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose.
All those people you went to school with and didn't really like. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing. I've got quite a lot of mine that I probably should get rid of. Was there any challenges for you being there? I know that we've spoken about how fun it was, but also were there any...
Well, the physical, the harshness of living there was a challenge, obviously. But you're all in it together, you know. It's like it doesn't just rain on one person, it rains on all of you.
Right.
You know. Yeah. So, yeah, you're all dealing with it in your own best ways. Other challenges? Yeah. You know, there were women that were attracted there who had very significant mental health problems, and that was really difficult because there was no way of helping them and containing them and... you know, caring for them appropriately, but, you know, everybody had their own ideas about the mental health services, you know, so that was difficult. But that didn't happen at the beginning. That happened. I only lived there for 18 months, but towards the end of that 18 months, I did see, you know, more and more women seeing it as a haven, as a safe space, which it was, but it wasn't designed to contain women that needed that help. And that then became quite stressful, really, because we didn't know how to help them, but we knew they needed help, you know, but there wasn't a way to really facilitate that. So, yeah, that became quite stressful.
Did you feel responsible for each other?
Yes, very much so, Yeah, it was, because we were a women's community, you know. Yeah. And so there was a feeling of solidarity and of trying to help each other. And we always looked out for each other. And, you know, and that's something that I don't see women doing today, you know. And my girlfriend now, when I first met her, you know, I offered to take her dog to the, you know, whatever, to the dog school. And she was just like, and she said to my other friend, I just met her, she's offered to take my dog. And my friend said, well, that's what women did then, you know, they just helped each other. It wasn't like this big deal. It's like, you need help, of course I'm going to help you, why wouldn't I? And I think that's lost now. I don't see that in action anymore. For my generation it is, but not for the younger generation. They've lost that connection, you know, that feeling of...
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, good question, isn't it? Why do you think that is? Maybe they're like, I mean, you know, we lived in communal houses, we were unemployed, so we shared resources. You know, they don't have to do that anymore. We live in a very insular society now, don't we? Like, you know, people look after themselves, really.
Mm.
And that's maybe the difference, is that you don't feel you can ask people for help. Whereas then, you didn't even have to ask, it was offered, you know, and if you asked, of course it was given.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think society has shifted to a more... what's the word for that culture? Mono? Is that a mono? I don't know. Where people...
I know what you mean. I think kind of looking after your own family and your own interests and your own... Less kind of tribal way of being, if you like.
Yeah. Survival of the one rather than the group. It's more competitive. And we weren't competitive. That was another...
Right.
You know, there was no... I'm not a competitive person. I hate competition. But, yeah, because for me it's about... surviving as a group.
Yeah. And I suppose you at Greenham had this common aim as well of, you know, getting rid of these weapons.
Indeed, yes.
That's what you're all there to do, you know. I suppose, even with the women coming for slightly different life circumstances and reasons, there was still this common thing that united them.
Well, it was to reclaim the common, really. Right. It wasn't just getting rid of the nuke, it was getting rid of the whole base because it was on common land.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was always that. It's like, who the fuck are these people? And we did it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
We did that.
Where were you when, because you had obviously left Greenham by the point where that actually had happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember where you were when you
No, unfortunately not. No, my life had moved into other directions by then. So, yeah, but we did go back. We went back, me and my subsequent girlfriend went back just to go on the common.
Right.
And I remember we stood on where the silos used to be. Mm. And I was just like, well, I thought they were radioactive. I don't know if we should be standing here. Oh, I don't know if it's good. And then you just think, were they ever there?
Yeah.
Because they were radioactive. That was the whole bloody point.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the whole thing was very odd.
It felt like almost they'd never been there.
Yeah, because all the land had grown back. You know, that was the point. We always knew that the land would recover, and it did. It recovered beautifully.
Mm.
Yeah. Weird.
Did you go to, because there's a little garden or something that's been created.
I heard about it, but I didn't go.
No. Just wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
I haven't been.
No.
It's where the tower used to be, isn't it? Somebody told me. Yeah. They wanted my things. I said, you're not having my things. No, go away. Yeah. I'll decide what I'm going to do with my things. Exactly. So there was a call out for like bits and pieces like, nah, not yet. Moving on.
Mm. Was there, you spoke about kind of with the Rebel Dykes project that you'd held on to a lot of stuff, like archive material, if you like, from your life. But was there a particular reason you held on to the Greenham stuff?
Same reason. I just knew that one day it would be valuable. I just knew that. I don't know why I knew that. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I just thought, and I've been incredibly lucky, I've never had to move.
Oh wow.
So I've lived in this house. I had my 21st birthday here. So, and that is so rare in London. It's social housing. I got a social housing, I can hang on to it.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very, very lucky. And so because of that, I never had to throw everything away, because most people just go, oh, you know, can't take every, you know, chuck that. So, and I never had to. So that was a real blessing.
Mm.
Maybe if I'd had to move, it wouldn't have happened. But there we go.
Yeah, maybe, who knows? But did you feel, when you were living at Greenham in that 18-month period, did you feel that what you were doing was going to be remembered and was important?
Oh, that's an interesting question, isn't it? I think you don't at the time. You don't realise what you're doing and how important it is. No, I don't think I did. No.
Did you have any encounters with the locals?
Loads.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them loved us, not all of them. You know, we would go into Newbury to go shopping, obviously, you know, we needed food and things, everything, shops, you know. So, yeah, a lot of the people were quite harsh, you know, we'd get names called in the street, you know, dirty lesbians, like, yes, that's us, whoa! Also, I think they must have been, I'm hazarding a guess that they were the Quakers in Newbury. I seem to remember that, because we were very supported by the Quaker movement.
Mm.
And so I think it was members of the Quaker movement in Newbury that would let us go to their houses for baths and, you know, just to chill out for a bit. Because it did get very, very difficult living outside all the time. Mm. Yeah. But,
so
yeah.
They'd let you in to just give you a bit of time. Yeah,
and a nice hot bath. You don't realise how lovely a nice hot bath is until you haven't got one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that something you missed the most, or were there other things you missed?
I think, yeah, that probably was one of the things I missed the most. Just being able to feel... I mean, you never really relaxed there.
Mm.
You know, you were constantly on high alert for all manner of reasons. But, yeah. Mm. So, yeah. But, we made up for it in so many other ways that at the time... I was young, you know, I was just having the best time.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't mind if I didn't have a bath. But when I got one, it was nice.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I was wondering if, because I've heard that there was some... you know, encounters with the locals that weren't as pleasant, and but you know, they were very much different groups, like kind of young men who'd come and say horrible things and throw things at the camp and things like that. I was wondering if you had any.
No, I think that may have happened more at Bluegate because it was nearer the pub. That's my guess, but that never happened at Maygate. That I can remember.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we had trouble with the bailiffs. You know, they were paid thugs. But
let's talk about the bailiffs.
Oh, come on, then.
That
was hard. That was really, really hard. That was horrible.
So, what were their tactics?
Their tactics were they would arrive really early in the morning, like, at dawn, and, you know, there'd be a shout out, the bailiffs, the bailiffs! And you'd be like, oh, shit. So you'd grab all your things and, you know, put your clothes on and just try and get as much out of your bender as you could. And then they would come with, like, I can't remember. I mean, in my mind, it's like a JCB, but it may not have been. And just, like, scoop everything up and put it in a truck and there goes your home, you know, and all your possessions.
Yeah.
Because the building, that it wasn't legal to have them there. So, you know. But that's why we built benders, because they didn't cost anything. You know, tents were quite an expensive resource to keep replacing.
Right.
So we built the basic minimum structure. Mm. And then, you know, then they'd go, like, 2-3 hours later, and then just start again.
Yeah.
And they didn't, it was sporadic when they came. You know, you could go for a long time without them being there, and then there they were again, Newbury Council.
Do you think they were trying to surprise you by keeping
definitely.
It sporadic?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. You'd just get all relaxed and settled back in, and then there they would be again.
Mm.
Paid thugs.
Was there some kind of rule that if you claimed something, they couldn't take it? Or was there... Because I've seen some footage of women kind of sitting in cars and saying, this is mine, and them trying to get them out of the car and things.
Probably. And, I don't remember that.
No, it's fine.
I can't say. I didn't have a car.
No, you just had your bender. How many... I'm just wondering how big the bender was. Like, how many people could fit in it?
Well, if you all sat around the edge, I mean, because you'd have a mattress if you were lucky, or, you know, some of those, one of those rolled up bed things. And, they came in different sizes. It would depend how long your poles were to start with.
How long the bed was.
Yeah. So, you know, you could always fit at least four... Yeah, and you know, you'd go sit. Do you want to go and sit in my bender? Oh, come on then. Did you go and sit in your bender? Oh, come on then. Yeah, it was lovely.
Yeah.
But that's how communities are forged, isn't it? Mm. You know, that you go through something really difficult together.
Yeah.
And then you look out for each other. Yeah. You know? Because it was never, oh, I'm going to grab my things. It was like, no, I'm going to grab everybody's things.
Yeah.
You know, come on. We're all. And that's the difference.
Mm.
Yeah.
That is different.
Yeah, because if you weren't there that day because of whatever reason, we were still going to get your things as well. Of course we were.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
Yeah. With the bailiffs, you said they were thugs. So was there any kind of violence against the women?
Never against me. I don't know. They couldn't touch us. Are you kidding? No, with that, no.
Not the bailiffs.
No, because, but we knew that. I mean, we knew our rights. We were well educated on our rights. So, no, they couldn't touch us. We'd done them for assault. We'd have done them. Bingo.
Yeah.
I mean, the police were a different matter, you know, because it was us and them, because we were breaking the law. So, of course, they could touch us.
But yeah.
Not the bailiffs. You know.
Yeah. So, with the police, let's talk about some actions. So... You mentioned, obviously, Embrace the Base when you first came. Were there any other kind of significant actions in your mind that you remember being a part of?
The naked action.
Naked
that was
action?
Good.
I've not heard about this.
Well, that's because you haven't interviewed a Rebel Dyke yet. Now, the naked action, that was so much fun. It was really, really hot. And I don't know who cooked this up. It definitely wasn't my idea, but I went along with it. It was like, you know, it was the summer. So if I arrived in December, so it would have been that summer of 84. And we were going to do a blockade, but the blockades were becoming less and less successful, really, because the police would just march out, pick us up, you know, dump us on the side of the road, and then the traffic would go in again.
Mm.
So I thought, right, what can we do that will, like, you know, really freak them out? So I was like, I know. let's be naked. I was, oh yes, that's a good idea. So so on a hot summer's day, we were all in the clearing and we all got undressed and we walked back around and, you know, we'd smeared ourselves in period blood. I mean, we were not messing about. And we just sat down in the road naked and they freaked out. They really just were like, I mean, we were there for a long time. They did not know what to do with us because they just were like, oh no, hold on a minute, this is a step too far now. And so they had to try and get women police officers, obviously, to come and, like, you know, pick us up. But what they did, which was, because when you're blockading, they pick you up under the arms and they drag you off and you've got shoes on. So then, you know, you'll scuff your heels. But when you're naked, what we hadn't thought was that they're still going to pick us up under the arms and drag us off and then out. Yeah, so all the backs of our feet were ruined. That wasn't very nice. But yeah, I think that was probably my favourite action of all because they were just so freaked out.
Oh my God, I'm just imagining their faces.
Yeah, it was like, oh no, now what?
Yeah, I'm not going near that.
That's why I knew we were just so naughty, you know, we just thought of all these things. And, you know, then we'd be in the base and, you know, because, of course, once you're arrested, you're in the base because that's where they take you. So there we'd have a jolly good old look around, like, oh, what they got here. They'd always take us to, like, this one holding cell. But one day I escaped. I got off the bus. And this wasn't in the naked action, by the way, but the bus, they take you over to the holding cell and then they're going to take you down to Newbury to the police station. Because there was this kind of an unholy alliance between the US Air Force base and the British police, because they couldn't prosecute us.
Right.
So they had to call the British police to do it. So then they took us down to Newbury Police Station.
Okay.
So one day they were getting us off the bus and I just legged it and there was this bicycle and I was like, I got on this bicycle and I was riding round and round and round and just like, oh God, what are they doing? I mean, I just had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And that was all part of it, you know, the personal was political. Whatever you did, you were doing something political, so that was handy.
Yeah. So were you arrested quite a lot?
Arrested quite a lot, but I was never charged.
Okay.
So that was good, because I mean, so many women went to prison, you know, and they've got criminal records now.
Mm.
And, you know, for a lot of those, I say a lot of those women, I know too, that has come up in jobs they've applied for. And, you know, where they're not really meant to have a criminal record. And they've really had to stand their ground and state their case and, you know, explain why.
Mm.
So, yeah. No, I never, ever went to prison. Thank goodness. I didn't fancy that. Although women that went said it was like a holiday camp, you know, because there were loads of them and they all went together. And it's like, you know,
yeah.
Wasn't as bad as...
There seemed to be a bit of a conveyor belt almost of women who were going for a week and then coming back. And so...
Yeah, that never happened to me, thank goodness. I wouldn't have managed that. I wasn't up for that.
Mm.
No. I always got off in court.
Got off. I just love the image of you running around on a bike and people having no idea what to do. It's just so funny.
That was all of us. It wasn't just me. We were all like that, you know. We were all just full of devilment, really.
Yeah.
Just like our job was to make their lives really difficult. So they'd fuck off.
And it was very, it was very creative as well, like the ways in which you would.
Oh, it was very creative. Yeah, it was very, very creative. Well, you know, put a whole load of women together, what are you going to get, you know? All these different approaches.
Yeah.
And nobody ever said no. That was the thing, nobody ever said no, you can't do that, because there was no one to say no.
Right.
So whatever you wanted to do, you'd do it.
Yeah. So that's, I suppose that's why there was this huge range of different kinds of actions.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely.
Because there was so much range. I mean, so an artistic expression, craft, and
I mean, you put something on there about reflect the base, and I'd forgotten about that. But that's the day we all went with mirrors.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
I remember doing it. I don't remember anything else about it. I mean, it wasn't until I saw it there that I was like, oh, yeah.
Because
we wanted to reflect the energy back to them.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we were all, you know, witches doing spells, you know.
Yeah, well, with the kind of creativity, and you're obviously a performer now, do you think that your time at Greenham influenced your...
Yeah, for sure. I played the guitar around the campfire. I sang. I wrote songs. a few of us did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely, definitely. Mm. Singing was a big part of it, actually. We sang a lot.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and in protest as well.
And in protest. Yeah. When you're blockading, we would sing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you have a favourite song?
Can't Kill the Spirit, I suppose. Mm. Yeah.
It's a good one.
It is. It's in my show, actually.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
So your show is, and you talk about Greenham in your show.
I do. Yeah. It's a big chapter. Yeah, cool. Well, it's 40 years of gay pride, so
yeah.
Starting in 1978 and what I was doing for each, not each year, but each chapter. And right. Greenham's chapter 2.
Think about that. how do people, how do people respond now? Do you talk about Greenham a lot with people? Yeah.
Oh, I have done recently, obviously because of the show. Mm. And some young people, it's so funny. I was at Elfest last year and this woman wanted to interview me for a radio station. And I mean, she must have been, she wasn't a youngster. She was late 30s, early 40s. And she was just like, I'm sitting here with a woman who actually lived at Greenham Common. I have never even met anybody who even went to Greenham Common. And I was just like, really? Wow. So it's like, you know, the further into history it gets, I suppose, the more amazing it gets. Like, and she's still alive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She can still talk by herself. That's nice.
So do you think people, I mean, that reaction is quite a positive one, even if it's crazy. It's are people mainly, quite positive, or do some people not know what it is?
A lot of young people don't know what it is, of course. Why would they? You know, but when you tell them, they're, okay. And then they Google it.
Cheeky Google.
Yeah, there you go. And then, And so, I never get anything negative ever.
No.
Never. No.
When you first, when you were there, did you ever, in the 18th month period, did you live there solidly?
Well, I used to come back because I still had this flat.
Right.
So I was very lucky, and lots of women would come back here and have hot bars and, just nice, chill out. Yeah. So we kept this as a place that you could come to.
Right.
So when you say solidly, I don't know. I mean, I had to sign on, so I had to come back every month.
Oh.
I never stopped signing on.
Yeah.
So, so that was lovely.
Yeah. So you were mainly there the majority of the time, hugely, but sometimes...
And then we'd hitchhike back to come
did
and
you,
sign on.
Because I'm just wondering, because I know that there was some movement between, camp and real life, quote-unquote, and I'm really curious as to that, did you have any kind of social interactions while you were technically living at Greenham, but away, and did people think of you in any certain way because you were a kind of Greenham woman?
I don't know. I mean, I think when we came up to London, we would have gone to the lesbian disco, and it would probably have come up, but I can't remember anything particularly happening. No.
No.
Probably was, but it's not in my memory.
No.
No.
Cool.
Might have been recruiting.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
For sure.
I mean, how did... You mentioned some of the reasons people might go to Greenham. How did people find out about it?
Word of mouth. Yeah. Word of mouth. And, we had papers.
Mm.
I couldn't tell you what appeared in papers, but, the mainstream press reported on us.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like people didn't know it was happening.
Mm.
People did know it was happening.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And then word of mouth.
Did you meet anyone there at Greenham that you might not have met otherwise?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Hello, everybody. Yeah. The people came from all walks of life. I mean, really, all walks of life.
Mm.
Because we were all petrified of a nuclear attack. You can't imagine. Adverts were shown on television of what to do in the event of the 3-minute warning. That is the world we lived in. I mean, you can't imagine.
Mm.
And it was like, protect and survive, hide in the cupboard under the stairs and eat tin food for 2 days. Yeah, that was bullshit. It was such bullshit.
Yeah.
And when we went there, we learned that that wasn't true. We met women who'd survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Women came from all over the world to Greenham. you know, to educate us, to be with us, to stand shoulder to shoulder with us. Yeah, we were on a knife edge, political knife edge. And, it, you know, regardless of what I say about all the fun I had, it was really fucking serious. That Cold War, you know, there was this constant fear of somebody pressing the button. You know, it was really, whether or not it was exaggerated by the press to make everybody more frightened, I don't know, but we were frightened.
Mm.
You know, we could have got blown up. But, you know, nuclear war, nuclear fallout, we all learned about what a mushroom cloud was. You know, I mean, you don't even know what that is, but... Yeah, it was a very, very real threat between America and USSR. That's why the missiles were at Greenham, because it was nearer, because they couldn't reach them from America, so they plonked them here, and in Comiso, in Italy.
Mm.
So, yeah.
It is a crazy time, because that threat and that fear is still, and is so, so prevalent then, and I do feel that now, even though... You know, we still are trying to get rid of, you know, there are people still trying to get rid of nuclear weapons in general, but the fear has almost just, you know, we've gone very apathetic about it, and it's kind of...
But they're not on British soil anymore.
Well, that... Yeah,
that's the difference.
Yeah.
You know, because now, I mean, we have nuclear weapons, but we'd have to press the button.
Right.
But before, it was like, okay, the Americans have put these missiles here... We didn't want them. Go away! Mm. You know, but now Russia could attack England... Because we've got their weapon, but they're not ours. Hold on a minute. You know, but that was the threat we lived in. Have a cheeky Google of Protect and Survive. It's for real.
The film.
Yeah, there's a film.
I have actually seen that. I know. Terrifying.
And that's the world we lived in.
Yeah.
You know, so there was this huge impetus for us to do something. You know, and as much as I'm playing it down and making it sound like it was all fun, it was. But there was a very, very serious reason why we were there.
We wanted
to save the world, and we did it. Yay! Yeah. But you know.
And you wouldn't have put up with all of the cold and the rain.
If it wasn't for
it
that.
Wasn't important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you said you were there for about 18 months, so you did a winter.
Yeah, I couldn't do another winter.
Couldn't do another one.
No.
No. Was it really, really bad?
Oh, it was vile. Yeah, it was vile.
It's cold.
Cold, wet, grey. You know what winter's like. And then try being outside all the day, every day.
It doesn't sound fun,
it's winter,
I'll be honest.
But worse. There's only so many waterproof clothes, you know, it's very hard to dry everything once you get wet. Yeah. You know, it's brutal. It's like being, on the streets, I suppose, in a lot of ways. That's why I have so much respect for people that can actually even live on the streets. You know, it's hard. It's really hard. Just the basics of keeping clean.
Yeah.
The real basics.
Clean and dry. And the fact that you had this throughout the bailiffs, you couldn't make your more permanent shelter.
No, nothing.
No. Yeah. Was there a decision point where you were like, right, I need to leave now and I'm not coming back, or did it...
No, I think it just happened like that. I probably came back here in the end, you know, probably around October, November, and just thought, nah, you're all right.
Yeah.
Stay here.
It's enough
for now.
Was there anything about the camp that you missed?
Oh, of course, the community. Mm. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Very much so. But then there was a lot of us in London, you know, I'd made lots of new friends, I wasn't isolated anymore, you know, so that had all changed. And then I went to live in Amsterdam because my girlfriend, who I lived in at Greenham with, got another girlfriend, and they lived in a squat just over the way there, and then she got a new girlfriend. And they were like, you know, on my doorstep, I was like... Not enjoying this either, but I suppose what had happened at Greenham was I'd learnt that I will survive. I'm such a survivor. And so I went to Amsterdam for a 2-week holiday, and I met some women there, and they had squats, and I met women there that I'd been at Greenham with. And so, you know, we had this global network of women around that, you know, oh yeah, you were at Greenham, oh then you must be okay, you know, like that's like your stamp of credibility. It's like, oh well, come and live in our squat. And then I lived in Amsterdam for 3 years, you know, because I knew how to survive. So that was a skill I learned that I didn't know I could do. That was cool.
Yeah. And it's survival in a not just in a literal sense, but in a kind of, you know, emotional well-being kind of sense.
Survive
as well.
And thrive as well. I had a band out there. I really, all because of these connections we've made at Greenham. And I bet whoever you ask will be able to give you incidences that are similar, you know, because that was a very solidifying experience, really.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love that story of, it really is, you know, it's almost like a movie, like you're coming and you're feeling isolated and then you end up being connected with everyone, all of the globe, like women all over the globe. It's really quite
very much so.
Amazing, actually.
Very much so.
I was going to ask what a question there, but I don't know if this even applies, because it's, how was it returning, you know, back to normality?
Well, I never did.
Exactly.
I wasn't in normality to start with, love, do you know what I mean?
And I have actually found that, you know, with quite a few people who went to Greenham, like, they started it living unconventionally way before Greenham, actually. And it was it wasn't a sudden change,
no,
you know.
I think for some women it was. Like, some women came, like, left their husbands. You know, women, a lot of women who thought they might be lesbians went to live at Greenham.
Wow.
They were.
Yeah, turns out.
Surprise! So, you know, women left families, husbands, kids, you know, to save the planet and the rest, and discover themselves. You know, I think you discovered a lot. When you're living in that environment, you know, you are face to face with you. Do you know what I mean? You can't, there's nowhere to hide, you know. So, yeah, you are going to find out those things about yourself. And that was really good. And I think that, you know, when I say it helped me give up hard drugs, because, you know, I realised that I was a nice person. You know, I had something to contribute to society. You know, there was a validation. I think I've used that word before, but there was a validation of you as a human being, as an individual, that you can do something. You know, maybe that's now, people have lost that feeling. You know, we're so battered down by these. I don't even use the word politics, but however our lives are being controlled. You know, we are very, you said earlier, numbed. I think that's a very good word. But we've lost the feeling that we have any power, you know. And we used to feel we did, and we did. And I don't know where that shift happened, really. But I think that is a very sad indictment of society today, is that people just think, oh, well, there's nothing I can do, you know. And we never thought that. We always thought, well, there's obviously something I can do, you know. And that whole thing of us being the 99%, you know, it doesn't seem to have really made enough of an impact on people that there's something they can do. They just think, oh, well, that's how it is. You know, it doesn't have to be like that.
Have you stayed part of the kind of activist peace movement post Greenham?
No, not at all. No, I've moved more into the, I've been very incremental in making things for lesbians. So I've been very focused more on gay rights and, you know, that part of politics.
Which is also, to be honest, a huge, seems to be a factor of Greenham as well, like they were, you know, peace movement was there, lesbians, gay rights, but it all seems to, and women's rights, you know, all of those things were
important. All tied in together.
Untied.
Very much so.
Cool. And we've got one question that we're asking everyone.
Okay.
I know. We'll ask it to you now. And it's, could you explain why you think it's important Greenham is remembered by subsequent generations?
Well, everything I've said.
Yeah.
Because it was unique. And, yeah. Important. And successful and fun. And I mean, you know, we always must stand on the shoulders of giants, and so you need to know who your giants were. There you go, that's my quote.
It's good. What was your biggest takeaway as an individual from Greenham, do you think?
Being an out and proud lesbian. Definitely.
Cool. Is there anything else that you want to
don't think so. No, not right now. No, I think we've been very comprehensive. I think we've covered pretty much everything. Yeah, I mean, it saved my life and it changed my life. And I think it did that for all of us, actually.
Mm.
I don't think there's a single person that lived there that wasn't very fundamentally touched by the experience. And there's never been anything like it since, so I think that's what's so beautiful about it, really.
Yeah.
About preserving it. So, yeah, I'm glad we are. Oh. It's great. Well, it's better to do it now. We're all still got our marbles.